Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Coven.
Hi, and welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast. My name is Dr. Mark McNair, and I will be with you today. I am glad to have with me today Estefana Johnson. Estefana is a clinician, trauma therapist, and I'm looking forward to it. Estefana, could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. My name is Estefana Johnson, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker out in Arizona, practicing in Gilbert, and the director of clinical training for Arise Alliance in out of Tampa.
And we had talked earlier about you sharing a bit of your story, and you were fine with doing that. So I want to invite you to do that now.
Of course. I mean, we're human first, even though we do, as clinicians, we do a lot of work with people. That's really, we're in it with everyone else. So my story, I mean, really, I feel like maybe not unlike other people, except in the way that my family is from Mexico. And so I was first generation Mexican-American, which presented its kind of its challenges coming here, where my home was one world, where we spoke Spanish, kind of was raised in a cult with very rigid rules. And there was a lot of trauma that was handed down, generational trauma that presented a lot of adversity, including, you know, everything from abuse, physical aggression, domestic violence, things like that. And also the poverty. So we lived in an adobe house with a dirt floor. You know, I tell people if you swept the floor too long, you end up with a basement. So you got to be mindful of those things, you know. But when I was probably about 7 or 8 is when we moved into an apartment, which is more of a normal house. I realized later how much those early experiences really have impacted the way I see the world, the way I understand people, and especially those that come from minority populations, because I didn't learn English until kindergarten. You know, it's a monolingual Spanish speaking household. And not only was it like cultural differences, but coming from a cult where you have all these rigid rules, it was a whole different world. And so as a kid, I can't imagine, I know what it was like, but now looking at other kids, I see how hard going when you have parents who split up and you go from one parent's house to the other, you have different rules. But I'm talking about different worlds. And so the portal was the crosswalk that took me from my side of the street where my house was to the school. And it seemed like because those worlds did not merge at all, I just never did very well academically because by the time I got home, there was no homework. There was no school. It was everything that was in that world. That along with being Spanish speaking and not knowing English, I struggled a lot academically.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of challenges that I faced. And yet deep, deep inside me, there was something that told me you have more. You have more to give. You are more than this. And I never forgot that little voice because I remember as an 8-year-old, I felt very misunderstood and, you know, looked like as a bad kid. Because of course, you know, with the history, there was a lot of aggression. I was always in trouble, always in the principal's office. And now I understand that little girl was just fighting to survive.
Yeah.
And so looking back now, I see how much that has impacted me in the way I work with people, in the way I approach the things that we face in this field.
Tell me more about that.
So when I first, being Hispanic, and I don't know how much of your audience is Hispanic, but maybe there's other cultures that can connect to this, but we didn't have mental health. I always joke around that if we wrote the DSM, it wouldn't even be a page, you know, it'd be like a paragraph. It's one diagnosis. It's está loco. It's it. So like, if you have depression, if you have anxiety, if you have whatever, go wash dishes and you'll get over it. It was very, very rigid, very kind of judgmental about it, but also normalizing. It's just part of you're crazy. So you got to fix it, which is damaging in a lot of ways, but also in other ways, there was more acceptance, I guess, of some of the struggles and the issues because they were not pathologized. They were more like looked at like character, personality differences. So I do feel that impacts the work that I did. Even when I first came into the field, I never planned on being a therapist as a grown-up. Some people say I always dreamed of this.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything other than cleaning houses or being a housewife. That was like the dream from immigrants, a home of immigrants. And it just happened kind of by accident where I landed in this field selling furniture at Montgomery Wards. And it was like closed down, I think it was in 98 or something like that, 99.
Yeah.
And my manager allowed me to put up an ad next to my register. So I was there one day and a lady came in and she said, "Oh, you're looking for a job." She said, if you give me a discount on my couch, I'll get you a job. And she happened to be an HR lady for a behavioral health hospital. And so that's kind of how I got into the field.
Okay. Yeah.
There was a couple of, they were split up into units. And I really felt drawn to the kids unit. That's where I first was exposed to therapy and looked at what the field was doing. And it just didn't make sense to me. I heard some really terrible stories and I saw some really heavy, heavy stuff with those kids that came in. And they would do a lot of cognitive approaches where they had them do worksheets and identify thinking errors and change the way you think and kind of punishment for making poor choices.
Yeah.
And I remember one girl that had attempted to take her life multiple times. I think the time that I met her, it was like her 13th time and she was 13 years old. And it was horrific because in the little short time that I worked there, I might have worked there maybe 6 months, she had been like successfully discharged and then returned 3 times in that period. And I thought, what, something that we're doing here is not working.
Yeah.
And I think it was more of that anger towards, or maybe some curiosity, but also a little bit of outrage over the injustice or misunderstanding. Something needed to be understood better that drove my passion to look for other answers. And then I ended up in the field as a career. That's where I went. So over the course, you know, as I became a therapist and worked with trauma, as I said, started with like the cognitive approaches, it just didn't seem to be enough. So I was always searching for more. And there's so many amazing modalities out there that can help process certain experiences, help desensitize memories, help kind of reframe experiences or beliefs. And it can be very costly, a lot of time and effort.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the challenges that I had was it seemed like each modality, there would be this really strong encouragement, like, this is the way, because here's the research that says this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. And it worked with some, but then there was missing pieces that didn't quite fit. Then I'd go find another one. And then that one was like, this is the way. And this is the only way because there's research behind this. And I'm like, well, it's different, but there's some similarities. And over time, I was kind of looking for what is the thing that connects mm-hmm. them all? What is the thing mm-hmm. that, well, we could be more intentional with knowing when to do this and when to do that. And I came across this organization. I became a trainer for one of the modalities that I absolutely loved. They used mm-hmm. image replacement and felt like it was the most efficient way of addressing like flashbacks, nightmares, the targeted images using bilateral stimulation. And then over time, very passionate, became a trainer. But over time, I started noticing missing pieces. And the answers didn't quite satisfy. It didn't make sense with other things I had learned or the research I was finding. And so I kind of went on this mission, and unbeknownst to me, there's other people, of course, that are on the same mission. Mm-hmm. And at one point, this opportunity presented itself where we were able to come together and look for those answers, try to sift through and say, what is the pattern? What is like the algorithm, if you will, mm-hmm. to why some people can go through the same exact event and struggle and others be able to seemingly get past it a lot easier. Yeah. And so that became our mission, is to discover the most organic way to heal, really. So over a period of a year and a half, maybe is how long it took to put together CMI. But I would say it was in development far before we got together, because we brought everything that we had learned, everything that research taught us about effective trauma therapy and how memories work, how our sense of self is developed, how emotions, like the role of emotions in digesting experiences. And that's how CMI was born. And so we launched training about a year and a half ago, back in 2024. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, Mark, it's one thing to put something together. It's another thing to make it replicable.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a journey to get to this place.
Somebody's listening and they're wondering, what does this look like? How would you begin to conceptualize and explain some of the modality to them?
So critical memory integration is based on the idea that everything that we do, how we look at the world, how we think, how we respond to situations, even the emotions that emerge within us in response to a situation, comes from experiences, earlier life experiences. And these experiences could be within our conscious awareness or not. As you think about like how your nervous system responds, that starts getting wired far before we're even born. It gets wired in the womb. And yet that is memory, right? It's information, it's data that is stored within the intelligence of the body. Mm-hmm. So memory first, when you think of it, think about it as a larger thing than just what you can consciously recall. It's data, it's information that is stored. And that information kind of drives the way we respond. Everything from our biological aspects of response, like our breath, the nervous system response, to the psychological as well. So how we perceive things, how we interpret experiences and situations. When we have experiences early in childhood that are adverse or we don't have the capacity yet to digest, sometimes those things get stuck and we have to adapt. So as a kid, there was a lot of things that were happening that were overwhelming for me. And so my system is wired in such a way that it's going to try to preserve, right, survive the situation, the environment. And so it went into fight. You know, there's fight, flight, freeze, collapse. So mine went into fight. While the fight mode helped me survive those circumstances, but over time, that adaptive response became a problem. Why? Mm-hmm. Because you can't be fighting when you're an adult. You can't be doing that. You get all called into HR and there's all these other, you know, mm-hmm. legal ramifications that make it now a maladaptive. What people, I call it outdated. It's just outdated because it developed for a reason. And there's a lot of things that we do that we learned really were programmed essentially, right, based off of our experiences. So you might have another person who goes into the people-pleasing mode and they're really stuck on it. In our field, we start teaching them to think differently. And that's like a surface level approach, because if this comes from a survival mechanism, it's way deeper than by the time the thought comes, you're already wired in that direction. Mm-hmm. When you get stuck in these loops of now you know better, but you can't seem to pull it off when you really need to. And I was seeing that a lot, particularly with people who had adversity, childhood adversity, where they're learning to think differently or manage their feelings, but it became this constant competing against something that is deeper. And that was the issue that we saw. And those are what we call critical memories. So they're experiences that have become kind of like a policy procedure manual in how we engage mm-hmm. with the world. And that's what mm-hmm. we're targeting.
Help me with this. When we're talking about memory in this construct, we're not talking about memory. We're talking about memory, the whole thing.
What you remember is but a fraction of all the data that you hold. Right. I mean, think about even knowing how to walk. You don't remember learning how to walk. Maybe some people do. But you know how to walk. Where is that information stored? Because you weren't born walking, right? Your muscles had to learn to hold you upright, all of those things, even language, talking, eating. You see a baby try to eat and they don't know where their mouth hole is. Just the learning where your body is in relationship to your hands. All of those things is memory. When some of the, let's say you have attachment things that happen. We know that attachment strategies form very early on from the time that you're born, but you're not going to remember probably the first few months of your life or the first few years, not consciously at least. And yet those experiences are so critical in the way you respond, how you engage in relationships, how you view yourself particularly. Because if we, as a kid, we put meaning on things, not intentionally, that's just the way we're wired. So if we had parents that were not attuned with us and we felt not seen, we felt worthless. And now you carry this within you. And there's no amount of self-talk that's going to change that. You have to connect to that critical experience. You have to integrate it. You have to connect it and update it to let it know that was back then, that experience, but the truth is different. The truth is that you do matter, and you have to experience that within yourself in order to change the way it's stored.
How do you create safety in doing this?
Safety, and this is as a clinician, this is the thing that we try to teach clinicians, how much our state, our response plays a role in that safety for the individual that you're interacting with.
Okay.
So our nervous system can communicate. I think they say our heart has like this field at about 8 feet outside of our body. And you've experienced this, Mark. Have you ever walked into a room and something's up, like it's just tension in there? Logically, you didn't observe anything happen, but you know something. That's that field. It's your nervous system picking up. I call it like the spidey senses. And we all have that. When we talk about interventions.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
As a therapist, we always have heard about how much the relationship matters more than the actual intervention. But to really break that down, what does that mean? It's not about us sitting there chit-chatting about our personal business, right? That's not, it's how you as a human relate to me as a human. And that, what matters is how I show up in serving you. So if I come in thinking I have the answers, right, or with an agenda of where we need to go, that might not be what you need in the moment. And my professional or my approach might actually reinforce that something's wrong with you that can't be fixed. So you can only go as far with me in exploring these things as I have gone with myself. So if there are things that I'm afraid of facing because there's that dark history that I don't want, that brings shame and I don't want to address and I shove it in the closet, and now I come and I'm working with you and you say something that activates a little bit of that memory, my nervous system is going to be like, oh, that's a no-go. And it tenses up and it tries to push it away. You don't know what's happening internally in my head. All you know is something shifted.
Right.
All you know is now there's a block between me and you. And so providing that safe space for you to go there, if you have not had a lot of experiences with safety, is going to be reliant on that relational experience of where I am with my nervous system, of if I'm anchored, and if I can provide that safe space of unconditional positive regard, where you can be you and you are accepted as you. That becomes very difficult when we're confronting thinking or trying to do corrective stuff. So it really starts with the clinician providing that. When you show up, if you're able to, the things that were really terrifying for you to share, the things that are scary to look at, it feels different when there's somebody with you, willing to go there with you. Have you ever had an experience where something that's really hard to do and then a good friend or someone pops in and says, I'll do it with you. I'll join you on that.
And there's that, hopefully that co-regulation that takes place as a result of that.
Yeah. Yes, it's what we call co-regulation. So if you have a clinician that is afraid of your responses, that is going to impact how far you can go. In fact, it could even cause more damage because it reinforces that the things you carry are too big to handle. It tells your nervous system that it's too dangerous. You already survived it. It's in the past.
I love, we have had Dr. Dan Allender on, and he talks about the fact you can only take people as far as you've gone yourself. I love that concept.
Yes. Yeah. And that's going to impact your experience with any therapist that you approach, whether you're doing CMI or anything else. But particularly with CMI, it is absolutely crucial because as therapists, we're not doing the cognitive work, right? We're not looking at the narrative, the story. We're really tuning into the experience that you're having. So during a CMI session, often the individual's not sharing a lot of details about what they're addressing because they're going through it internally. And you can pull up a memory like instantaneously and go through it a lot quicker. What takes a lot of time is if you have to articulate it and try to explain it and then trying to like tell you, hey, is this what it is? You're like, not quite that, but this, it takes a lot of time and it tangles up. And now you leaving just as bad as you did when you came in.
And so many clients I have found don't want to talk about it. They want to feel the safety of being able to process it. And many times I have found people being willing to talk about it afterwards, but not in the beginning.
No, because it's not historical yet. And trying to articulate something, especially something that's terrifying, your brain won't allow it. That Broca's area, the area that is responsible kind of for like the verbalization, you know, the talking, it shuts off during a really highly emotionally charged experience. And so even if they did, a lot of times their words get stuck in their throat. They feel helpless to it. And it reinforces the helplessness associated with that experience. And that's where I felt we were going wrong. In the field when I, the first thing that I trained in for trauma with kids, it was supposed to be like the gold standard. And it involved the kid talking about the terrible things that happened. And I started noticing these things and I started noticing the kids, their heart rate would jump up, you know, 128, 150. That's ridiculous. Like this 12-year-old's going to have a heart attack in my office. Why? Because this is what therapy's supposed to look like? No, we've got something wrong. And that's part of what kind of drives me.
So if somebody came into your office and they want to begin with a session, what would that look like? We had talked earlier about the fact that, you know, a lot of times there's not a lot of data taken and that's a unique approach even in itself.
Yeah, that I really need is where are you in terms of your capacity to handle really discomfort? Is it something that if you have someone that's in active like trauma state where they're having flashbacks, panic attacks, very little tolerance, it's too much. There's going to be, it's like having someone go to the hospital and too many bones are broken. We got to let the bones heal before we start working on rehab, right? So There has to be sufficient internal awareness and capacity to handle discomfort and distress. And I can tell you, most people are there. Most people. There's very few, even with complex trauma, there's very few that have not developed some capacity to manage and navigate through discomfort. So more often than not, I can have an individual come in and I don't need the history because it already shows me through the body, right? The way you respond, the things that you're stuck on or the things that are repeated, those already tell me enough. I don't have to know the details about it to know there was something there. More importantly, it's about your awareness that this is something that is not congruent with who I am in my life, and how I'm responding doesn't feel right. So with that awareness, that's all we need. And then your willingness to go into the discomfort. Sometimes it could be a person that says, I know I shouldn't talk to my loved ones this way, and yet I struggle and I get so angry with myself because my temper's so short, or I overreact to things. Or there's these moments and I try to talk myself out, but I don't know why I feel anxious. It doesn't make sense. Those are all what we call signals that we can start with and we can explore. And if you're willing to go there, I've done CMI with during the intake, and it takes a few minutes where you're the one that's finding the answers within you. I'm not doing the work. I'm just guiding you through it. So some people can go through a session pretty quickly. I would say an average like 20, 30 minutes, even for the deeper ones. If I have those few individuals that have very little resources, we may need to work on a lot of that, establishing that type of connection to the self before we really dive deep. But that's why it's important. For me, I never say, hey, let's look at big T traumas or little T traumas or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I just don't do that. I want to, there's a couple of reasons. Number one, we're already assuming that's the problem. Experience is not the problem. It's how you digested it. That's the problem. It's whether you had the capacity to go through it. That's the problem, right? The meaning, what happened within you because of that experience. That's the problem. The other piece is we're all biased, whether we want to admit it or not. We look at the world through our lens. We listen autobiographically, which means as you share something, it might be terrible to me. And to you, it was like, that's life. Sometimes I tell people, yeah, I was raised in a dirt home with dirt floors. And they're like, mija. And I'm like, it was all organic. You know, that was normal. It wasn't anything that was traumatizing to me. I understand how the lack of finances maybe provided stress and impacted the family that way. But the home itself was just the place that we lived. And that's an issue, too, with sometimes getting a lot of details on things, is that we put our interpretation on it. And that puts me at risk to getting your way of your healing.
Interesting. Very interesting. So you have been doing this for a while, and I'd like to ask people, as you've worked with a lot of people, what have they taught you about trauma?
Oh my, they've taught me everything. Everything. Anything that I know, you know, there's so much more to learn. Probably the primary thing is like, this isn't something to be pathologized. This is called life. This stuff happened. You know, through generations, through humanity, it's not anything new. The other piece is really acceptance and compassion for us and our humanity is so desperately needed. And unfortunately, you know, in a capitalistic society where we have this thing of what the ideal is supposed to be, we lose sight of the real in search of the ideal. And the real is really authentic, active. That is living. That is enjoying life. That's where the true joy is held. Not in the seeking of something different. It's being with what is, accepting what is, and the beauty of it.
What came to my mind, that idea that if it's, you know, if the aspiration is up here or the concept is up here and you don't meet it, and I don't think anybody does, but, you know, then shame comes and you just don't feel good enough.
Yeah, you choke. I got the visual of you can... Aspiration can cause you to aspirate. Yeah. You can choke on that, looking for something in it. You panic and thinking that is what I need. No, what you need is right here. You have it. all these experiences that we've had, I really look at the beauty of the journey. And it sounds maybe even offensive for some people because they're in the midst of it. So I don't mean to diminish someone that's in the midst of that darkness. But I'm going to tell you something, Mark. If people didn't share adversity, right? How many of you would watch a talk show that had nothing but people who were like, yeah, I was raised in a great family with healthy parents and a white picket fence, and I went to college. Good job, Susan. It's not impressive. We become strong because of the adversity. And I'm not, again, I don't want to diminish people who say this has broken me, because I know that could be very offensive. It's when we get to the other side, when we discover our true power, and that requires us to break out of the identity of being a victim. You have to discover your true identity. And there is nothing that you could go through in this life that could define you without your permission. That's what I've learned from the people I've worked with. Horrific, horrific experiences. Amazing, powerful individuals.
Yeah, and I think that idea, I just want to clarify, it certainly does mark us or name us as kids, but it doesn't have to continue with some really good work. It doesn't have to continue. We don't have to carry that story.
No, you can choose to. But in my field, what I look at my role is just to expand the table of possibilities, right? Mm-hmm. You have this terrible story. It'll always be on the table. You can pick it up as an identity if you want. But we want to add other things to the table. You can define yourself. And this is the piece, being Hispanic, Mexican-American. It was a lot of, you're wetback, you're this, a lot of racial put-downs. And I'm not saying just generally, like, even from my own people, now you go to school, you're all educated, you think you're all bad, you think, like, this betrayal that you have against what the norm is. And what I realize is how much, when we accept that, that is what keeps us. When we decide that I'm going to go do this regardless if I have your permission or not, that's when we discover our true power. I remember first reading that story of the 4-minute mile. You ever heard of the 4-minute mile? Mm-hmm. Or before the 50s, they used to think that if you ran any faster, like your heart would explode. And it was one idiot that decided to completely ignore every doctor's recommendation, every professional, all of the people who decided this was our limit. And what happened after that? That's now the standard, minimum standard,
right?
For an Olympic athlete. I believe it's probably faster. But those are the things that happen with us, is that we go through these experiences in childhood, things that we connect to our identity, to what I call our meat suit, right? And we think that that's who we are. That's not who you are. You're bigger than that. But you're the only one that can discover that.
I agree with you. And I think the key, and you alluded to it earlier, is that idea that we have to have people come along with us to help us feel the safety, to help us work with the body, for us to be able to, I would use the word metabolize this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Digest it. Yeah. Digest those experiences, because they're past. You already went past them. But your brain needs to update to know that that was then, this is now. Back then, these things were a threat to our life. The people pleasing in particular, when people say, why can't I just not do it? Because when you were little, if you spoke your mind, if you did, it was a threat to your connection with the caretaker that fed you, that clothed you, that housed you. And if you lost that connection and they abandoned you, that means you could die. So it was a life or death response back then. Now, as an adult, it doesn't make sense, right? Because you can take care of yourself. But back then, it was a survival mechanism. So we always talk about fight, flight, but really that appeasing that happens is another survival strategy. So it really shifts the way we look at these things, these adaptive strategies, what people do and where they get stuck. And only the individual knows somewhere deep inside whether that's aligned with who they are or not. Somewhere in there, because it's like this thing that keeps playing in your mind, this thing that is undigested, unmetabolized. Yeah, and that's what we're doing with CMI, is following those, helping you support your digestion process. Once you've done it a few times, it becomes your baseline. You know how to do it.
This has been so good and so enlightening. I'm going to ask you to let people know, if they want to find out more about CMI, or if they want to find out more about you or your work, where can they go?
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you asked that, Mark, because right now there's so much demand for it, and we're hoping The biggest issue right now is having providers, because I know that a lot of listeners are going to want to experience this, and we need more therapists that are trained because it's newer. So hopefully if there's any therapists listening as well, they could look into this. But our website is ariseallianz.com, and you can go there for more information, to contact any questions that you might have. We do everything from webinars to connecting with organizations. We've developed some programs for organizations that want to bring some of these concepts into play. But any clinicians too, we need more providers.
Thank you for this time, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.